Too young and too short, and there were no female captains. And my dad said, be patient, he said, just see what happens. But I took my first lesson, came down from the sky, and told my father I'd fly for the rest of my life. And I got my first job, flying for a mortician in a tiny bonanza, just a corpse and me. $5 an hour for flying dead bodies. I had to climb over their faces just to get to my seat. Then
Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 19th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today, we have Jenna Tessa Fox and Michael Portantier. Jenna is a theater writer and reviewer whose articles have appeared on at TimeOutNewYork.com, Playbill.com, BroadwayWorld.com, and NewYorkTheaterGuide.com. Good morning, Jenna.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Peter had a drama desk executive meeting or something along those lines, which they also schedule on Sunday mornings. So I appreciate Jenna jumping in and helping us out at the last minute.
Always glad to be here.
But folks who are looking for trivia, we will have it. So stay tuned.
The drama desk guys and women must be going nuts with so many shows opening. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this, because of course the drama desk covers off Broadway as well. So not only the, you know, 25 Broadway shows that are opening this spring or whatever, but all of those as well. That they must be, they're very hard workers, those people, and they just deserve a lot of credit.
Absolutely.
Very true. I mean, to be honest, I can only get to the major off-Broadway openings and the Broadway openings. I can't do the smaller ones. I just don't have the time in my schedule to do it. So I can't even imagine what the Drama Desk Executive Committee is, what their time commitment is like. With us today, we have a very special guest. Rick Pender is with us. Folks may not know Rick's name, but we do know Everything Sondheim, which is the awesome new website and print publication that Rick has pulled together. He's the executive editor and publisher and is joining us by telephone from Ohio. Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
So tell us, you know, what was your impetus for starting Everything Sondheim?
Well, for about a dozen years prior to when we got this kicked off a year or so ago, I was the editor of the Sondheim Review, which had actually been around since 1994. So it had about a 20-year run, but it had some business problems across its last few years and ceased publication just about a year ago. That motivated several of us who were involved in editing and writing to say, we're not done with this yet. And so we decided to have put together a website and a magazine. We did some crowdfunding about a year ago and raised the funds we needed to build the website. And that launched over the summer. And then our first print issue came out in February of 2017.
That's awesome. You know, many of our listeners, including all of us around this call today, we're big fans of the Sondheim Review and are very excited that Everything Sondheim kind of picked up the trail right there and made it into something new. So, you know, starting up this whole thing, what was the biggest challenge for you?
Well, I guess it was funding. Part of the struggles of the Sondheim Review was that it did not get all the funding that it always needed, and its publisher often had to put some of his own funds in to make it go. So we knew there would be a bit of a challenge to doing that. And I guess the other challenge we faced was that with the demise of the magazine, its subscriber database was not available to us. So we've had to do a great deal of promotion just to get the word out that that we exist. So we're very appreciative for opportunities like this to help more people find out that we're out there and available.
We have a big U.S.-based listenership, but we also have a global reach. We have get many emails from Europe and Asia and Australia. A lot of listeners in Australia are folks who are international able to subscribe.
They are, and we already have some. I would say we must have 7, 8, 9 countries already represented. I just processed one to Germany this morning, in fact.
Oh, that's really great. So tell us about a little bit about Rick Pender. You know, you from 1994 to 2015, you were involved with the Sondheim Review. But what made you get involved with the Sondheim Review?
Well, I will tell you, it wasn't quite in 94. That's when it started. I wasn't involved at the time, but I took a trip to Chicago in the mid-90s and discovered this magazine in the gift shop at the for the Goodman Theater when it was still in the Chicago Art Institute. And it was being published by some folks who had Chicago roots. So I think that's part of why it was available there. I saw it and thought, wow, a whole magazine about Sondheim. And I was already a fan of his work dating back to, well, I will tell you, the first LP I ever bought, for anyone who remembers LPs, was the soundtrack for the movie of West Side Story. I didn't really know who Sondheim was at the time, but I loved the music and especially the lyrics. So I'd had a great deal of history with Sondheim shows over the years. So seeing the existence of this magazine and having learned in about, I'm going to say 96 or 97, that the Cincinnati Playhouse, where I live and also work at least part-time as a theater critic, was going to be producing Sweeney Todd. I offered to write it for the magazine. The then editor was glad to have the coverage, and that was my first contribution. And then over the next several years, I became a more frequent contributor and eventually an associate editor. And then in 2004, went through an editorial turnover, and I became the managing editor at that point.
Wow. So does Everything Sondheim have any formal connection to Mr. Sondheim?
Well, I wouldn't say formal, but we certainly have an informal connection with him. I communicate with him whenever that's needed. He's not directly involved in the production of it, but he helped us during our crowdfunding drive a year ago. He autographed some copies of his two volumes of lyric studies, and he and James Lapine autographed copies of some of the scripts of Sunday in the Park with George and Into the Woods that we could give out to folks who made substantial contributions to our endeavor. And then if I ever have questions trying to clarify a detail or something that I can't find in any of the print materials that I have, his books or other things, he's always very responsive to email queries that I sent his way.
By the way, the one show I ever saw in Cincinnati, coincidentally, was Company with Raul Esparza before it came to Broadway. So so that's my Cincinnati.
That was a fabulous opportunity.
Sondheim connection.
Here, and I actually, with them performing that here, I got to interview many of the cast members and with John Doyle, who staged the production. So it was really a wonderful thing. And then to see it go on and do so well on Broadway was just the frosting on the cake. The birthday cake, of course.
The critical birthday that he had. Rick, also, I got the chance to listen to some great interviews that you did for your WVXU around Cincinnati radio life. So you have a little radio life out there as well. And the show is
really good. Well, thank you. I really enjoy doing those interviews with a lot of, it tends to be interviews with locally based theatrical productions here in Cincinnati. And I'm a theater critic and write for Cincinnati City Beat, which is the local alternative news weekly. So I do have those kind of connections. And I was that newspaper's arts editor from, from 1998 to 2006. And it was during the time that I also began working with the Sondheim Review. So when WVXU began to change some of its programming formatting when it was acquired by Cincinnati Public Radio, which also manages a classical music radio station, they created this talk program about local arts. It's called Around Cincinnati. And I handled lots of interviews for them from my position as the arts editor at the paper. When I left the paper, I continued to do exclusively theater interviews for them.
I'm so sorry. Peter's not with us this morning. Peter Felicia is not with us this morning. He had a drama desk meeting, but last week he got over to University of Cincinnati at the College Conservatory of Music and saw Mac and Mabel starring sophomore Alex Stone. Have you gotten a chance to see this production?
I did not, and I was out of town last weekend, so I was unable to see it. Unfortunately, those wonderful productions at CCM are very short. They usually are just like 3 or 4 days. So I had to miss that one. I'm excited, though, there's going to be a production of Stephen Schwartz's Children of Eden coming up very soon. And I perform a similar function. Peter comes out and does watches the show and does some commentary with the students and the staff about it. And I do the same thing when they produce in their smaller studio theater for those productions. So I'll be doing feedback for this production of Children of Eden that's upcoming.
Wow. So Cincinnati has a double Peter Felicia-like people who could do that. So it sounds like Cincinnati is a great kept secret in the performing arts.
We have a pretty good theater scene locally here. But our larger art scene is also quite impressive and pretty comparable with a lot of the work that you'd find in New York and Chicago and that sort of thing. We have a great symphony, an opera company, a ballet company, all of those kinds of things, in addition to our theater scene.
Jen, are you going to say something?
Oh, I was just saying I would agree. I've heard a lot about the arts scene in Cincinnati and that it's highly regarded with a lot of great educational opportunities. These schools there have great arts programs, and it's a really flourishing arts scene. So, yes, I'd be very happy with dedicating some more programming to the arts beyond New York City and specifically focused on Cincinnati.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to talk about it anytime. And I'm sort of a voracious arts consumer here. So I worked for Cincinnati Opera for several years. So I have some insights into their operations too. Mm-hmm.
Well, Rick, we would love to get you back on and let's talk about what's coming up with everything Sondheim, what's happening in Cincinnati. If you'd like to come back, I want our listeners to get over to everythingsondheim.org. Do you guys also have the .com just in case? Or did somebody take
we do. It'll, if they go to that one, they'll end up on .org. So, yes.
Yeah, so everythingsondheim.org. And check it out, a great website. And as Michael and I and Peter talked about last week, the print copy of your magazine is beautiful as well. It's execution.
Oh, thanks.
It's execution happening on the highest level. So check it out and support Everything Sondheim, because these type of things are, we just can't get them anymore. That's really
James.
Great.
If I might add one thing to further entice folks to subscribe. Our first print issue is out already, so it's gone out to our subscribers. But I am telling folks that anybody who subscribes before the end of March, we will mail out a copy of that first issue to them, so they will be sure to receive it, and then the subsequent issues that'll be coming out quarterly. So they'll get a complete set that way.
I was wondering if maybe you could also tease us on some specific articles or interviews that are upcoming.
Oh, sure. And we are working on the next issue, which will be coming out in May. It looks like we're going to have a package of material about assassins. There's a number of productions around the country that we will have some commentary on, and an essay. The current potential title for it is What Assassins Tells Us About Today. And I will leave you to extrapolate from that as to what that might be about.
Yes.
We also have, I think, what's going to be quite an interesting series of interviews. John Bell, an academic from Pennsylvania, got to know Elaine Stritch very well in the final years of her life. And he did quite a bit of interviewing with her, and he's going to start providing us with some of that material. So the first installment of that will be in the magazine. And then I think subsequently we'll have shorter episodes that will be on the website.
Great.
That sounds really great. So if you want to subscribe now and get that first issue to be a completist in your Sondheim world, please get in touch with everything at Sondheim.org as soon as possible. Ricky, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak to you soon.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks to all of you for the conversation this morning.
Thank you very much.
Yes, bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Well, they can get their own drinks.
In our review section, Michael, Jenna, and I got a chance to see Come From Away. Peter talked about it last week. So, Jenna, why don't you start us off with Come From Away?
Like Peter said last week, there were very few dry eyes in the house, and I was among the people sobbing by the end. It's a really impressive musical. I was, I went in with as much doubts as anyone. I mean, the idea of a 9/11 musical just sort of raises hackles, I think, for a lot of people. And this isn't a 9/11 musical. It's a 9/12 musical. It's a 9/13 musical. And it's about, in the middle of this horrifying situation, the kindness that people can show in the worst of humanity compared with the best of humanity. And I think this musical does a beautiful job. Irene Sankoff and David Hine, Canadian writers, have done an amazing job conveying, balancing horror with comedy and with kindness and genuine drama. And it's a real mix of emotions. And the show can really take you from crying in 1 minute to cheering in the next. And it's, you walk out feeling happier, I think, at the end. It's like a catharsis, a classic catharsis of emotion when you can compare such horror with such human kindness. They did a lovely job conveying different types of people from all around the world who are all stranded in this small Newfoundland town as the world is changing far away from them. And they've got to learn to, they've got to deal with the world changing and people being scared and angry. Meanwhile, the locals of Gander, Newfoundland, who are taking in all of these stranded come from aways, their local term for outsiders, they are suddenly put on the spot and they have to open up their home. Well, they don't have to open up their homes. They choose to open up their homes to these outsiders. And a lot of the humor of the show comes from comparing the come from aways with the locals and their different values, their different mindsets. Rodney Hicks has a great ongoing bit where he is sent out to collect barbecue pits or barbecue, what do you call them? Barbecues, to host a cookout. And he's told, oh, you can just collect the barbecues from people's backyards. And his character is a New Yorker and keeps saying, I'm going to get shot if I take people's barbecues. And he goes, he starts walking around backyards to take people's barbecues. And then he says, I am offered a cup of tea in every home I rob. It's this fantastic moment, and he plays it just beautifully with this growing awareness that people aren't scared of him here. And that, I don't know if the character the story is based on was also a black man or what, but I loved this image of people welcoming someone into their community and saying, sure, you need to take the barbecue to have a cookout, take the barbecue. And that we see him, his perspective changing, as for once he's not being treated with fear and suspicion, he's being welcomed. And that was, I thought, a really lovely moment. It was funny, but it was also poignant in its way. Jen Colella really gets the only solo of the show. And her song, they need to follow the Hamilton rule and add a few extra measures of music. After one of her lines, she sings about how she, her character was the first female captain for American Airlines. And I missed the next few lines because the audience was cheering. And I hope they'll add a few extra bars of music to just let the audience applaud after that line, because that was fantastic. And audience was with her and cheering her on. It's this powerful song, but I rather wish the show was a bit longer and had a bit of a larger cast to go more in depth into more of the characters and what they're dealing with. There are a lot of group numbers. Almost every song, as Peter mentioned last week, is credited to the company. And there are not a lot of solos. We don't get a lot of alone time with many of the characters. And I rather wish we had been able to do that if this was a traditional two and a half hour musical with an intermission rather than 90 minutes and no intermission. I very rarely want shows to be longer, but I really would have been happy had this one been longer and gone deeper into more of the stories.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I think that this story itself, this true story, is so incredibly compelling that obviously they were starting from a great place in that sense. And I think choosing to write about this was very wise. I imagine some people might have shied away from it. And I have heard some people, I don't know about you guys, still saying they think it's too soon, or there should not be a show about 9/11, even tangentially. I respect that opinion. I don't agree. I think that it's handled beautifully in that sense. And the story itself, it really is quite amazing in the details as well as the larger points of it. Just the fact that this huge airport existed and still exists in Gander, because it dated from the days when, we're so spoiled nowadays, but it dated from the days when airplanes could not fly transatlantic without refueling at some point. And they had to land there and refuel and then continue on their way. So since it is, I guess, just about the easternmost point of North America, between North America and Europe, that this is where that huge airport was. And it had been underused for decades, I guess. And then this tragedy happened, and everyone was like, oh, gosh, we have all of these runways. I guess they were in good enough condition that planes could still land there. And so these hundreds of flights landed with these thousands of people, and they were put up in various places, people's homes, in high school gymnasiums and things of that sort. And the town really rallied and welcomed these people. And it's such a compelling story. And I think it's well done enough, the musical is, that it really does strike a chord, and a lot of people seem to be really loving it and wiping tears away. I do think there are some pretty big flaws in it, and I think it could have been better. Actually, Jenna alluded to one thing that I was going to bring up. I don't know if we went to the same performance, Jenna. I know James and I were at the same performance. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh, no, same. No, we were at different performances.
Okay. Well, at the performance that I attended, when Jen Colella sang that one solo, the one solo in the show, at the end of it, the audience really wanted to applaud and did anyway, even though they were not given a stopping place. And that relates to what I think is one of the biggest flaws of the show. I just thought it was very relentless. It's basically through sung. There's a fair amount of dialogue, but almost all of the dialogue is spoken over music. So the music almost never stops. And I think this show would have just been much more effective if that were not the case. I wish there were some more book scenes, and I don't see why the music has to continue, you know, start and then just keep going and almost never ever stop until the very end. I wish they hadn't made that choice. Additionally, although I found the music very tuneful and enjoyable, some of it did seem quite derivative. I don't know if I noticed specific tunes that it reminded me of, but I did think that a lot of it sounded derivative. And the lyrics, I think, would have been much stronger if there had been real rhymes rather than so many false rhymes. So those are two major flaws that I think. Also, I think, how do you guys feel about this? I think that in trying desperately not to be over sentimental, that maybe sometimes they went a little far in the other direction. There is, I'm thinking specifically, a subplot of one of the women on one of the flights. We learn that her son is a New York City firefighter, and she, of course, does not know what happened to him. And as it's presented in the show, she doesn't find out until she gets home 4 or 5 days later. And I won't reveal what that is. But I think that I found that very compelling, of course. But I kind of felt like it was brought up at various points. And then it was dropped for a very, very long time until we finally heard the denouement at the end. And then when we did hear what happened, I didn't think that maybe that necessarily had the emotional weight that it should have. So I understand why they did it, and I suppose it's certainly better than being accused of milking and tear jerking. So I don't think that's a major flaw, but it's just something else I noticed. Positives, I think that the cast was superb across the board. I think Christopher Ashley did an excellent job of directing, and I think we're going to Jenna's going to discuss Significant Other. One of my problems with that, as I had mentioned, was that I thought the doubling in that show was done very, very poorly. In this show, against all odds, it's done, I think, extremely well. We have 12 cast members who play not only of the people who landed in Gander, but also the local residents, and they switch back and forth. Everyone plays basically, I would say, at least two people. And somehow you wouldn't think this would be possible, but I thought it was done so well that I always knew who they were supposed to be. I never had a moment of, well, wait, are they the hosts or are they the guests? So I really my hat is really off to Christopher Ashley and the cast for that.
Yes, agreed. They did a beautiful job with that.
So once again, between Peter last week and the two of you this week, you've covered nearly everything that I was going to say. That's I thought I was going to get the doubling in, but Michael slid it in at the last minute. So yeah, for this cast to show off, you know, 12 people on stage to show off 40 to 50 characters, and us being easily able to understand the story without saying, oh, who is this? Who is that? They did it so well. Christopher Ashley did a great, great directing thing. I understand what you're saying about being 90 minutes, no intermission. Jenna saying that maybe it could have been a little longer, and Michael saying that it was relentless. But I think that added to my feeling of remembering this moment where it was like a marathon that right around 9/11 when and what these people must have felt like, you know, not being in connection with the rest of the world at first, not knowing what happened. I think they did a really good job. And as Michael was mentioning, some people may think it's too soon. I don't think so. I think that this is a very classy show.
Absolutely.
With a wonderful message, and I think it's what the world needs now.
I don't think there was not a moment when I felt queasy when I felt, oh, they shouldn't really have done that. I mean, so that whatever else you one might criticize, I think that they did a really excellent job of that.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And especially with everything right now, there's so much tension. Every time you turn the news on, it's kind of refreshing to turn on to go to a Broadway musical about a horrifying moment of history, and then to see the good that people can turn a horror into. It's really refreshing. And yes, I agree, it is relentless. And I hadn't considered that they're echoing the pace of, you know, the Newfoundlanders who were up for 5 days straight, making sure that these 7,000 refugees had some place to sleep, had enough food, had clothing to change into, and that their 19 animals on those 38 planes were taken care of. But I hadn't considered that they were echoing that frantic pace. So that's a very good point. I had not thought of that.
Yes, and I think that's very valid to do it that way. Just for me, I think if it had been tempered just a little bit. And the other thing is, you know, again, we our weekly thing. I from where I was sitting, it was too loud, and also not only too loud, but I didn't like the EQ. It sounded very tinny to me, and because of that, I felt that I missed a fair amount of lyrics. So
we didn't talk about the use of the band on stage.
Oh, the band was wonderful.
Amazing, awesome. And did you stay for the playoff?
Absolutely. And how often do people stop and stand there to listen to the exit music? I mean, there was no exit music because nobody was exiting. They were just standing there clapping along and cheering. And it was fantastic. And I will have to give a lot of credit to Hein and Sankoff for bringing in a lot of different types of music, since this, they had people from all around the world suddenly in this community. The traditional music from Newfoundland, since it's highly, you know, it's the people there are generally descendants of Irish and Scottish immigrants. So the music traditionally from that area is rather Celtic. So there's a lot of Celtic influences in a lot of the score, but then they bring in early aughts and late 90s pop music, since that's, you know, the appropriate time period. And they have all
every
kinds
time
of
they
different
did the Celine Dion thing, it was so funny.
It was hilarious. Yeah, but exactly. They bring in a wide range of musical influences, and they did just a lovely job with that.
Jenna, you referred to Hein and Sankoff. That's David Hein and Irene Sankoff, who wrote the book Music and Lyrics, just for the listeners
yes.
out there. I and Hein and Sankoff did another show called My Mother's Lesbian Jewish Wiccan Wedding, based upon David Hein's mother's true story, which was a fringe show. And they are Canadians, and hopefully we can see more from them. I think this is a really great outing, and I talked about what a great season this is shaping up to be.
One more wonderful thing about the show is that there are a lot of new faces in it, but also some people it's really great to see again. For example, Chad Kimball.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, he, for whatever reasons, he has not, I have not seen him lately in anything. And to have him back, you know, after quite a triumph in Memphis. And then also, Jen Colella, I guess the first time I became aware of her was in Urban Cowboy, and she has been in her share of shows that have not been hits. So I was really happy when I read before I saw the show that she was getting a lot of attention for this. And she does have the one solo, and she does a great job with it. And I think that's great for her. Also, Cesar Samoya is another familiar face to me. So, I think that the mixture of familiar and unfamiliar faces, that also really helped me to enjoy it a lot.
Yes, very much. And the cast works wonderfully as individuals when they have their unique moments, but they also work beautifully as a team, never stealing energy from one another, just working as 12, a unit of 12. And I didn't realize it was only 12 actors. I had to go back and check the playbill and, yeah, it was only 12 people up there. It feels like a much larger cast.
Mm. Yeah.
They did eight.
And with the band on stage also actors interacting with the band. I think it's a really well done show. I highly recommend it to folks who are looking for a good show to see. And again, you stand outside of the Schoenfeld and you look across the street and you see Dear Evan Hansen. You look to the west side and you see Bandstand coming in. I mean, just on that block alone, this is going to be a Tony Awards fight right there.
Yeah, it really is.
All right, so let's move forward into Anything Goes at Musicals Tonight. Michael got a chance to see this, so tell us about Anything Goes.
Well, they, as I've mentioned several times recently, the Musicals Tonight has really upped their game in recent years in terms of production values and in other ways. This show was directed and choreographed by Casey Colgan, music director and vocal arranger Christopher Stevens, and this was kind of I guess their own version of Anything Goes. As we, many of our listeners know, there are several. This show has been almost continually revised ever since, subsequent to the original production, with other Cole Porter songs from other shows being put in and others taken out. Although the plot has always remained basically the same, and so have a lot of the jokes. Original book by Guy Bolton and P.G. Woodhouse, then revised by Howard Lindsay and Russell Krauss. Some really, really funny jokes about these shenanigans aboard a ship that's headed between Europe and New York. And it's just the essence of musical comedy, but I think it's really a tribute to this show that it has survived and had so many revivals off and on Broadway, and of course tours and all over the country and high schools and colleges and everything. I was making a point. I did a talk back after the matinee performance yesterday at Musicals Tonight, and I said that really, other than Showboat, and I guess Porgy and Bess, if that counts, I can't think of really many or any other shows from the 30s or earlier that when they are revived, that they're done pretty much basically as they were originally in terms of the books. So this is one that has definitely survived and thrived, and even as recently as the Sutton Foster revival on Broadway was a big hit. And the previous to that, there was Patti LuPone. Then there was the off-Broadway revival with Hal Linden and Eileen Rodgers in 1962 that yielded a cast album that is one of the best ever cast albums made. But so this one, as I said, stuck with the book and the plot and kept all of those wonderful jokes. Some of the changes to the tune stack in this case, the song The Heaven Hop was sung by Reno and the Angels, not by the character of Bonnie. The song Let's Misbehave was done as a solo by Elijah J. Whitney. And that, I have never seen that done, but that gave him a wonderful moment. And that role was played so hilariously by Stuart Marlin that became actually a highlight of the show. Moonface Martin, rather than singing his song Be Like the Bluebird, he did Take Me Back to Manhattan. And the fellow who played that role, Carlos Lopez, did a great job with it. And I mean, it was quite charming and hilarious because he's supposed to be thrown in the brig, basically on the ship. He and Billy are alone in the brig, and he starts singing Take Me Back to Manhattan, and suddenly these chorus girls appear in costume and they're like, where did they come from? But it, in the way that used to happen in musical comedies in the 20s and 30s. So that was a highlight. And then here was the most interesting thing. The song All Through the Night is a beautiful, soft, gorgeous ballad that was written for the show originally and is usually performed towards the end by Billy and Hope. In this case, what started at that in that slot was the more famous song from not from anything originally written for Anything Goes, Night and Day. And at first I thought, oh, well, I love Night and Day, but I'm sorry that they're replacing All Through the Night. But no, as it turned out, what this was a kind of, it started out as Night and Day, then it went into All Through the Night, and then it became a beautiful combination of the two songs, which go together beautifully. I understand that this arrangement was performed before it was done in Musicals Tonight in a production in North Carolina, because Casey Colgan is involved in a theater down there, and I'm not sure if it was the same musical director and arranger of Christopher Stevens, but I think so. Anyway, they did a wonderful job of that, and it's so wonderful that it's like I kind of want to hear it that way from here on in. Really wonderful production overall. Tremendous amounts and of very, very high quality choreography performed by the cast, brilliantly performed by the cast. I won't name everyone, but Meredith Inglesby was a wonderful Reno Sweeney. Allegra Leland was Hope. Jessica Moore was Irma. And let's see. Allison Englund was Evangeline Harcourt. And Jeremiah Jin was Billy. Another winner for Musicals Tonight. I brought a friend of mine to this show who had not he had not been to to see Musicals Tonight in several years, and he has been lately really very, very impressed by how they've grown. They also do not use scripts at all anymore. I think what happened was they added maybe just a couple of rehearsals to their schedule, and that allows them to not have the actors carry scripts at all time. And of course, that makes a huge difference. Thing. This was the very first Musicals Tonight show that has ever featured anything more than a piano. They had piano and drums, full percussion, and that. If there's one show to add percussion to, this was a great one to make that choice. And they had them up on on the second level above the action, so that really helped. And I'm really glad that I saw it. The show is running one more week. I caught it at the end of the first weekend. So if you get there, it's going through the 26th at the Lion Theater on Theater Row.
All right. That sounds exciting. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. You can check that out. Next up, Jenna and I got a chance to see Significant Other over at the Booth Theater. So, Jenna, why don't you start us off with Significant?
I had very mixed feelings about this play. It touches on some very real and recognizable issues. In case anyone didn't hear Michael's review from last week, it's about a group of four friends, four straight women and one gay man, and they're all in their mid to late 20s, and the women are starting to form romantic relationships of their own. They're getting married and moving on with their lives, while the gay man is not moving on with his life, and he's still trying to find his soulmate, his partner. And as he watches each of his friends moving on, he gets incredibly jealous that they are moving ahead in their lives and he is not, and he still wants romance and love and he isn't getting it. It's, certainly a very real issue, and it's something that I think everyone goes through. Once you're out of school and people start moving at different rates or moving and growing at different rates, some people get married right away. Some people wait several years. Some people wait decades, whatever. It can be difficult, sure, to see people moving on and growing in different ways. In that respect, I liked what the play did. The script, oh my gosh, I just blanked on the playwright's name. I'm terrible. Joshua Harmon's play, Joshua Harmon's script does that nicely, indicating how people grow and change at different rates. That said, I found the characters in this play to be so incredibly selfish and shallow and vapid that it was just hard to care about what they were going through. It's hard to believe that they are all close friends because we don't see them behaving or connecting as friends. We see them snipping at each other and being snarky and not terribly supportive. All of them, they all seem to be worried about what can I get out of you? It always seems to be more manipulative than giving and caring friendships. And they just spend so much time whining about how unhappy they all are. And I just stopped caring after a while. It's a great idea for a play. But when the characters are constantly whining about, oh my gosh, I'm 27 and I'm not married yet, I kept wanting to bang my head into a wall. And not to say that every 27-year-old shouldn't be, I don't know, I'm not sure how to phrase that, but yeah, I mean, quite frankly, most 27-year-olds I know are not that concerned about getting married. They're, at least in New York, you're concerned about going out and what are you doing on Friday night? But again, I don't want to suggest that, you know, it's unrealistic because it paints 27-year-olds as more concerned with commitment than with casual romance. I just, the performers themselves were quite good. They did a nice job. Gideon Glick is a standout as the gay man who's being left on his own as his girlfriends move on. Although, honestly, in several scenes, I was getting real echoes of Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates for some of his bits. But you know, I got to sit in the second row center and looking right up at his face and the emotion that he conveys and watching his eyes well up with tears. He was throwing himself heart and soul into that performance. So big cheers to him for a very powerful performance. I just really wish Harmon's script let the characters be a bit more likable and less whiny, less petulant. Gideon Glick has a monologue towards the end of the play that I think was supposed to help. It was intended to make the audience sympathize with how frustrated and upset he is with the direction his life is taking. But it's performed at such a key moment in the play that it turns him into a monster. And that was the moment I lost all sympathy for this character after that monologue. Because I kept thinking, what kind of hateful person would say these things to a friend at this point in her life? How can you possibly be so selfish at this moment?
I meant, as you may remember, I mentioned that specific moment, and I just thought, I completely understand his frustration, but I just don't think their friendship could survive the things he
exactly.
says to her in that.
Exactly.
He'd certainly not survive after what he says, and then he shows up at the wedding anyway.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was, I completely agree with you. That's the problem. It was a good monologue, but it needed to come at a different point. Because at that moment in that scene, and I don't want to spoil things for our listeners, but in that moment, if a friend were to say something to me at that moment in my life, that would be it. We'd be done. And that would be unfriending on Facebook and blocking on Twitter. And that shocked me, honestly, that we're still supposed to feel sympathy for this character after he tears apart someone he's supposed to care about. He clearly does not care about this person more than he cares about himself.
Right.
And I think that was what I got from the scene. He's much more selfish and self-concerned. I don't say self-concerned, but he was much more selfish in that moment when he needed to be focusing on somebody else, and he refused to do that.
Right.
And that was my takeaway. So, yeah, that was my thoughts. What were yours?
So, I feel as though the significant other is suffering from some bad producing. I think that this show really needs to have the audience close to it, that this needs a smaller theater, and that if it doesn't have a smaller theater, it needs to have star casting only for the fact that we need to have a full theater where the audience is, you feel the audience engagement with the show. And that's what I really felt. I mean, it had to been when I saw the show the other night, 30-40% full. It was totally empty. And the energy is lost in a big theater, even though you might have a couple of hundred people there. In a theater that might hold, you know, over 1,000 people, it feels very empty. So, Michael, you saw significant other off-Broadway and on-Broadway. Did the size of the house make a difference to you in the feeling of...
Well, as far as the audience response?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling, you know, is that, you know, maybe a lot of... A lot of electricity is lost because of such a large house at the Booth Theater with an audience that it probably, you know, is substantial but is small in comparison to the house.
Well, when I attended, that was not the case. So when I attended on Broadway, so I guess I can't really speak to that fully. I wouldn't say it was packed, but it was certainly not even close to empty. It was pretty full. I mean, I think what naturally happens, for better or worse, when a play moves from off-Broadway to Broadway is that it gets ramped up in terms of the performance level and energy, and sometimes the comedy is played more broadly. I did mention one of the things I liked least about the show was that I felt that all of these four central characters, really, that there were many times when they behaved like 14-year-olds, just kind of screaming, you know. It's not that I think that doesn't happen, but I don't know if it happens that often. And it became very tiresome to me. And I don't recall thinking that as much off Broadway. So maybe that was one of the things that they ramped up as far as how they behave when they're out at clubs together and those scenes specifically. I really had a problem with that.
Unfortunately, I felt like Significant Other didn't translate to me in that theater. I think if I had seen it in a smaller, more intimate space, I think it would have been better. And I'm sure that there must have been something electric about it off-Broadway, or else they wouldn't have transferred it. So, unfortunately, I don't think it works here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great idea for a play, and there are some truly strong moments. Barbara Barry's moments of a grandmother connecting with her son. Those are lovely. But honestly, Barbara Perry was the only character I liked in the play. And I think that was the problem. I agree with you. The characters were screechy. They behaved more like teenagers than 20-somethings.
Yeah, that was a problem for me, to the degree to which they did it. So anyway.
Agreed.
All right, so let's move forward into The Price. Jenna got a chance to see The Price at the American Airlines Theater, which just opened.
Yes.
So Jenna, tell us about The Price.
The Price, I'm kind of ashamed to say I didn't know about this play. And, you know, I like Arthur Miller's work, so I was kind of surprised that there was this piece I was completely unaware of. The play follows, is about a family in the 1960s when the play was written, about 50 years ago. During the Depression, the family lost all their money and they were living in the small, I guess it looks like they're living in the attic of a family house. And now in the 1960s, the building is about to be torn down. So the younger son comes back to get a price estimate from a Jewish appraiser played by Danny DeVito, who steals every single scene he's on stage. He comes to appraise all of these antiques left over from the 20s and 30s in this attic. And for the first act, it's just looking over the different items and discussing their value and what they mean to Mark Ruffalo as the younger son of this family. Mark Ruffalo's character has been a beat cop for the past 30 years, and he's getting ready for retirement, but he's not sure if his pension will be enough for him and his wife, played by Jessica Hecht, to live off of. So they're counting on these antiques to bring them some money as a cushion for their financial security. And they spend Act One discussing the value of the items, and then Tony Shalhoub, playing the older brother, and the much more successful older brother, suddenly shows up and they send Danny DeVito out of the room, and it becomes a battle between these two brothers and Jessica Hecht as the wife of the younger brother about family history from 30 years ago and how they suffered during the Depression and who sacrificed what for whom and who was manipulating whom. And it's all of this family dysfunction and family drama comes out. And you just realize it's too late for any of these characters to make anything right. They were all doing, you know, making terrible mistakes 30 years ago. And now we're seeing the long-term effects of those mistakes from 30 years ago. So it's really, it's very powerful. And it's, you know, for any family that has had family drama, and I think every family has had some kind of family drama, they can certainly connect to this. But it's also really interesting to see, not to read hidden meanings or to read new meanings into a 50-year-old script, but, you know, turning on the news today and hearing people say that, you know, if poor people want food, they have to give up their iPhones, and seeing things like this, they need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and be self-sufficient. The play feels incredibly timely since it shows how two brothers made different decisions. One sacrificed, one gave up his dream of going to college and getting an education. He became a beat cop in order to support the other one, who went on to become a highly successful businessman. But the brothers fell out and haven't spoken to each other in years. And one sacrificed, the other took advantage of sacrifice, and their lives took incredibly different directions. So it's kind of fascinating to hear about, you know, here's what the poor should do. Well, here's what one family did and how they resent each other. The older brother resents the younger brother's sacrifice and feels guilt about having to take advantage of that sacrifice, while the other one resents being put in the position that he had to sacrifice. And it's very complex. The characters are very complex. Four actors doing a beautiful job. Danny DeVito is very funny as the banker. He goes deeper than the usual Yiddish shtick. And he has wonderful stage presence. I've never seen him live on stage before, but he is very funny, very witty. And Tony Shalhoub and Mark Ruffalo have a wonderful rapport together, terrific chemistry. Jessica Hecht as the wife who is, you know, as the women in that time frequently were, she's dependent upon her husband. And she sees her husband caring for everyone except them. He is always sacrificing for other people. And now she needs him to be selfish and to take a stand and demand what he is, what she feels he is due, or what she feels they are due. And the play is very powerful in that respect. It's a good drama. Derek McLean designed the set with furniture hanging from everywhere, hanging from the ceiling, from the walls. Really gorgeous, simple. I shouldn't say simple, but it's a single set for the entire play. And the stories that you can see in the pieces, these antique pieces all over the stage and hanging from the ceiling, hanging from the walls. You see a generation, a whole family's life suspended in midair. And really McLean really deserves a lot of credit for that. And Terry Kinney's direction is fantastic. It's a 2.5 hour long play, but it never drags. It never feels dull. So Kinney really keeps up the pace, and the cast works very well together to make sure this family drama never gets repetitive or dull or feels like it's lagging. So really recommend it. It's a powerful piece, and it just feels like any family that has had resentment can really connect to this.
I tell you, it must have been very difficult to grow up as Arthur Miller.
I can imagine.
I mean, yes. Amazing, amazing work, but oh, it sounds like it was so tough.
I was just watching an old video of a production of All My Sons that I assistant directed on Staten Island decades ago, and man, that is so true of that play. It's just one horrible thing after another. But you know, but please don't get us wrong. He was just a great, great, great playwright.
Michael, are you scheduled to see The Price?
I'm hoping to. I just recently realized that I completely missed the invitation. I got it, and
oh, no.
I It got lost in the shuffle. Because as we have mentioned, so many things are opening lately. It's just an embarrassment of riches. But it really I'm gonna schedule it. I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm gonna see it this week, and I think Peter has already seen it, so we'll try to talk about it next week or in the upcoming weeks to see where we are with the price. All right, Michael, you saw Bareback Inc. at IRT, which is down on Christopher Street. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it's closed, so I won't spend too much time, but I did want to mention it because it was very well done. This is a play by Rob Bartlett, directed by David Drake, and it's based on the myth of Ganymede, Ganymede's abduction by Zeus, with all the... In this production, this adaptation, the emphasis was on the homoeroticism, as one might think. But very interesting, there are two characters. The Ganymede character is called the Canvas, played by Todd Flaherty, presumably no relation to Stephen. And the other role is the artist, tattoo artist, played by J. Stephen Brantley, presumably no relation to Ben. but anyway, and so Zeus, the Zeus equivalent does not appear. What's happening in this play is that the canvas, Todd Flaherty, the Ganymede character, is coming to the artist, the tattoo artist, to be tattooed, I guess partly at the behest of Zeus. And they, the relationship between these two, the artist and the canvas, was, as I said, they're the only two characters. And that was really the meat of this play. The artist is a very worldly, been there, seen it all, much older person, and whereas the canvas is really like it's a blank canvas. This very young, beautiful youth who is going to be the canvas, and so they had a very fraught relationship, and that was the meat of the play. Interesting that the playwright decided to do it that way rather than to have Zeus as a character, but I actually think it worked better. And I thought it was very well done. A lot of it was very poetic. My only negative was that I thought that the ending was a little abrupt. The transfiguration of Ganymede, but very, very well done in a little black boxy type of space, especially in terms of lighting and sound by John Salutz, S-A-L-U-T-Z. And as I said, directed by David Drake, and just I look forward to seeing more of this company. They are in the same building, the archive building, where that has the I think it's in the basement. There's been a theater in the basement for many years, and I think the Access Theater is there now. But this was an upstairs space, just a little black box space upstairs, and I look forward to seeing what they have coming in the future.
All right. I just want to reflect back to we were just talking about the price, and at the end of the price, Michael talked about the embarrassment of the riches for this season. I pulled up my list. There are officially 43 shows in this season. And in March, 6 of them are opening, and in April, 13 of them are opening. So we just talked about Significant Other, and Significant Other was official opening was March 2nd. Glass Menagerie is the 9th. Come From Away is the 12th of March. The Price is the 16th of March. Miss Saigon is the 23rd of March, and Sweat is the 26th of March. So that's just our March. So hopefully we'll be able to fit all of these in by the end of the season. And
specifically, in, as we mentioned, in terms of new musicals, I can't remember. I don't know how far you have to go back to find a season that had so many new musicals. And not only that, but several of them seem to be doing really well. The three that opened in the fall... Bronx Tale, Dear Evan Hansen, and Natasha Pierre. And now it seems that Come From Away, certainly got a lot of wonderful reviews. And I think it's doing well. So who knows what what the others, how the others will fare. But it's just really, really exciting.
Yeah.
And I wonder what this will mean for next season, if there will, there are not a lot of limited runs. There are quite a few open-ended runs. And what will that mean for new shows coming in?
Yeah, I mean, there may be a boomerang, a slight, at least a somewhat of a boomerang effect for next season, or not. We'll see.
And yeah.
Then, you know, we have still Amelie to go. We still have Groundhog Day. We still have
Anastasia,
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Bandstand. I can't even, you know, we're going to have to go daily on this.
So. Pretty much. Every evening at midnight, we get home and we get on the get on Skype.
Excellent. So to wrap up the day, Jenna saw the Assembly's production of Homesick at Jack's Brooklyn. So tell us about that.
Yes. Really fascinating play. And I'll be honest, I've seen this a few times. Some friends of mine are members of the Assembly and helped create the play. And they keep bringing it back year after year. I think the first year was 2011 or 2012. And it's a really fascinating piece. It's just worth revisiting. That's why I keep going back to see it again and again. So the play is running, I think, through the end of March now at Jack's in Brooklyn, this tiny little space just off of the C train. And it's a really fascinating piece. It follows the rise and the fall of the Weather Underground movement, which was a splinter group from Students for a Democratic Society in the late 1960s into the 1970s during the tail end of the Vietnam War. And it shows how they went from noble ideals about equality and justice, and then they made a compromise and started incorporating violence into their ideology. Since the Vietnam War was violent, they would bring the war home, they said, and they would show people what it's like to live in a war zone so that they wouldn't want a war any longer. And when that didn't work and that didn't promote their ideals, then they started shifting their ideals again and again. I shouldn't say shifting their ideals, their methodology. Instead of peaceful protests, then they started bombing buildings. And most famously, the Weather Underground, while they tried not to hurt any people, and they would always alert building owners to, or they would alert the police to when they were about to bomb a building. In the West Village in 1970, people working on a bomb at a Weather Underground house, the bomb went off and killed three members of the group. And eventually, they wound up partnering with the Black Panthers for an armed robbery that did wind up killing some people. And that was pretty much the end of the Weather Underground movement. So the play follows their rise, their fall, and how they kept shifting what they were willing to do in order to bring about these very noble ideals as they start incorporating violence and then more violence until they're helping to get people killed. And that's what ultimately ends that movement. The Assembly is this group of artists that wrote the play. They, six of them, performed the play. Anna Abou Elliott, Edward Bauer, Ben Beckley, Kate Benson, Luke Harlan, and Emily Louise Perkins are the cast. They co-wrote the play along with Jess Chase, the director. One element of the play that I really like is that each of the actors breaks character once throughout the play to deliver a monologue talking about what the creation of the play meant to them and what they've learned about the ideology of the 1960s and how it affects them, how the ideals of the Weather Underground affect them. Emily Louise Perkins has this very powerful monologue about her privilege as a white woman and how she, researching this play and producing it and bringing it to life, has taught her to be more aware of her privilege. And that's a wonderful monologue. There are five other wonderful monologues as well, but it really connects the past to the present. It helps connect the audience as an audience to those universal ideals that these students were fighting for. And it, there are also several moments of audience interaction. The play begins with, you know, the actors directly asking the audience questions and helping to form a bridge between that time period and this time period and the different ideals of those two worlds. Notably, the company has invited former members of the Weather Underground to come and see the play and then participate in talkbacks after the play. So several characters who are mentioned in the script are then there, and you can ask them questions and talk with them, which is a really exciting opportunity. Mark Rudd was there the night that I saw it, and I don't know if he's connected to Paul, but that's another story. Never mind, anyway. Mark Rudd talked about how he really regrets his time with the Weather Underground and how they basically destroyed Students for a Democratic Society, which was a powerful organization in the late 1960s. When they felt that pacifism was not effective enough and they began promoting violence as a means to an end that fractured Students for a Democratic Society and basically destroyed it. Now, the CIA and FBI had been trying to take down this youth organization externally, but what wound up destroying it was destroyed from the inside. And then he said he sees this happening all over again with current liberalism, and that so much infighting among liberals is once again giving conservatives a leg up and giving them an opportunity to gain traction while we're still busy fighting among ourselves. And it was a fascinating talk back and just made this play seem incredibly prescient, incredibly timely. It was written, like I said, I think in 2011 and 2012. But it feels amazingly timely right now as people are discussing what they are willing to do to make their dreams happen, to make their ideal America a reality. And I really recommend heading out to Brooklyn. I hope they'll bring the show back. They frequently tour with it. The Assembly frequently tours with the show. So I really hope they'll bring it back, bring it to more cities, and that more people can see and discuss it and discuss the mistakes of the Weather Underground and what we can learn from those mistakes. And it's a wonderful opportunity of a wonderful example of how art can drive discussion and art can change the way people think about what they're doing. It feels like, in a way, it's almost a modern-day Hair, considering it's focusing on the same time period. But again, the way art can change the way we perceive contemporary politics, the play is a very strong example of that.
All right. So that is the Assembly's Homesick at Jack at 505 and a half Waverly Avenue in Brooklyn. It's playing through March 25th, so you have just a few days left to go check it out if you can, or hopefully it'll make it back, as Jenna mentioned. All right, before we wrap up for today, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a link there so that each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the iHeartRadio app, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn on your Amazon Echo, various other plays, as well as Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Jenna, for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. And a little teaser for next week, Peter got to see Rachel Lily Rosenblum, and don't you ever forget it. And he wanted to give us a review, but we couldn't get it in for this week. So tune in next week for a review of that. Much wanting to hear about that show, many of our listeners who are longtime fans of this show wanted to hear about this, so Peter got out and listened to it.
Oh, wow.
So Peter is going to join us for trivia. All right, Peter, thanks for joining us on the phone. Tell us what the answer to last week's trivia is.
Well, the question was, what famous one-word musical that has nine letters in its title originally went by an eight-letter title? All eight letters were included in the title, we know, but one letter was added up front. What was the original title, and what is the now famous title? And the show is Brigadoon, which was first called Rigadoon when Lerner and Lowe started working on it. Josh Israel was the first to get it, followed by Jed Slaughter and Donald Tessioni. Here's the new one. What was the first Tony-winning musical to include the musical scale, you know, the one that starts with Do, in one of its songs? Give the name of the song, too.
All right. Thanks so much, Peter.
All right. We'll talk soon. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks to Peter for jumping out of the drama desk meeting to record that for us. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Jenna Tessa Fox and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all I told him we'd have the other half in the afternoon.
Welcome to the wildest weather that you've ever heard of.
Where everyone is nicer, but it's never nice above.
Welcome to the farthest place you'll get from Disneyland.
Fish and chips and shipwrecks.
This is Newfoundland.
Welcome to the rock.
I'm in my car. The kids cross Airport Boulevard to get to school. At that time of day, people are in a little bit of a rush to get to work and stuff. So normally I sit there and run my radar. And if they're speeding, I'll stop them and write out a warning ticket. I'll write STFD. Slow the freak down.
Welcome to the land where the winters try to kill us, and we say,
we will not be killed.
Welcome to the land where the waters try to drown us, and we said,
we will not be drowned.
Welcome to the land where we lost our loved ones, and we said,
we will still go on.
Welcome to the land where the winds try to blow,
and we said no.
That morning I dropped my kids off at school and head to the SPCA, where I'm greeted by my other kids, all barking and meowing for breakfast and a belly rub. Not that I'm complaining, I love them. But by the time feeding is done, I got to get back to pick up my human kids. So I take just 1 second for myself, and I'm sitting in my car.
I'm in the staff room.
I'm in the library.
And I turn on the radio.
You are here at the start of a moment, on the edge of the world, where the river.
My radar when Bonnie comes by. She pulls up and she is waving at me like mad. So I roll down my window and she says,
Oz, turn on the radio.
Slow it down, Bonnie.
Jesus H. Oz, turn on the radio.
Here our story starts.
It's my first day at the station.
Where in the night?
I'm getting coffee for the picket line.
Where we know by heart.
5 minutes till my smoke break.
Every single flight.
I'm off to work at the airport.
Welcome to the heart.